Okay. As you know, most of you have been in our class here for the last few weeks and know that we are laying the foundation for a study of the book of Revelation. And I make no apology to the fact that we have spent a good portion of time on the introductory materials. I think it will serve us well as we get into the book. But if you have a study guide, then you'll be able to look over that, even if you were not part of the class here for the last 5 or 6 weeks, as we've laid the foundation for our study. As you know, the word revelation comes from apocalypsis, where we get our English word apocalypse. Now that Greek word simply means an unveiling, or a making known, an uncovering, if you will. The book of Revelation is written in what we sometimes call apocalyptic language. And that makes it very difficult if we're not aware of that. If we try to study the book of Revelation like we do one of the gospel accounts, that being biographies, or if we try to study it like we do the book of Acts, being a history book, if you will, a history of the church, we will struggle. We have to realize that it's a different style of writing. It's figurative language that's used in that. So we made mention here several times that some characteristics of the apocalyptic style of writing is that it grows out of a great conflict, and visions are used. It's expressed as a drama, for example. The key word, though, of the book of Revelation, I'd like to remind you, is the Greek word nikao. Nikao is translated into what English word? What is the English word? Overcome. Nike or nike is victory. Nikao is overcome. And the word overcome is a key word in the book of Revelation. Now, we talked about the author, Jesus Christ being the ultimate author, but that vision is given to, and the stenographer, if you will, of the book would be John the Apostle. There are dates that are argued for the book, but we're going to use here the one that's most commonly accepted, most widely accepted, and that being toward the end of the reign of Domitian. And he was the emperor from 81 to 96. So somewhere around the year 80, 95, or 96 is when we think the book was written. And the vision was given to John as he was in exile on the Isle of Patmos. The recipients, we're going to get into this a little more here in the next lesson or two. You will see on the wall to my left over here, the seven churches of Asia. And eventually to all of us, because don't you recall the scripture says in chapter 2, verse 7, he who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the seven churches. So that includes all of us. There are great lessons to be learned in the book of Revelation, and I hope that we can glean some of those as we go through it. We spent a lot of time talking about emperor worship. That's important for us to understand. Last week when we were together, we talked about some numbers and colors and significant words. And I think as we go through the book, when we encounter those things, it will help us to be reminded of some of the things that we've talked about. Numbers have a special meaning frequently in especially apocalyptic literature, figurative language. Numbers oftentimes don't mean what you think they would mean, you know, off literally. For example, we do the same thing today. If there were a large crowd of people, we might say there were hundreds and hundreds of people there. Well, what do we really mean by that? Just a lot of people. We don't necessarily mean there was 100 or 200 or 300. It was a lot of people there. Why don't we say there was 90 and 90 and 90 people there? You know, we understand when we talk about large numbers, hundreds or thousands of people. You know, we understand that's a big crowd. So numbers mean something even to us today, but we're very interested in what they meant to the first century Christian. Because remember we said for us to fully understand Revelation, we need to see it through the eyes of whom?
The original recipients.
The original recipients. That's right. Revelations through the eyes of the first century Christian is the name of a book about the Revelation. So, what did the numbers mean to them? We talked about it last week, the number 1 and the number 2. The number 3 is of particular significance, divinity, the Father, Son, and Holy Ghost. All of the numbers here, down to number 7. Number 7 is a very special number here, representing perfection or completeness. And we talked about that last week, but I went through this past week and looked at the number of times that the number 7 appears in Revelation. 52 times. 52 times in the book of Revelation alone. And a lot of times it has significance in the way that it's used. We talked about the colors, and then we also ended class last week talking about some special words that we encounter, that when you look especially at the Greek of some of these words, it really has a lot of meaning. Don't you remember last week we talked about the word lamb? And you'll find this on page 5 of your outline. But the word lamb here appears as two different Greek words in the New Testament. Amnos is the word that will appear throughout the New Testament, but not in Revelation. Amnos is what's translated lamb. We find it in John 1:29 when he says, "Behold, the Lamb of God that takes away the sins of the world." Now, what does Amnos mean? That's a lamb for sacrifice. A lamb for sacrifice. But it's very significant that in Revelation we don't find Amnos. The word that's translated lamb in Revelation is arnion. And arnion is a word for lamb which is not a lamb for sacrifice, but a lamb which lives. Now that's very significant, I think, that we see Jesus as the victor. Jesus as the King. King of kings and Lord of lords. He's no longer the sacrificial lamb. He's the lamb that lives. We talked about that last week. And we also talked a little bit as class ended last week about the last phrase there on page 5. And that being entahos. And entahos is what's translated in verse 1 of must shortly take place. Shortly take place does not mean that it's going to happen in the near future. Now, some of the things did. Some of the things were happening, as a matter of fact, as the book was being written. Nero was the first emperor to persecute Christians. And then Domitian came along, and he had persecuted Christians. A lot of the persecution was already occurring, and it would continue to occur. But entahos means that it'll happen quickly. When it happens, it's going to happen quickly. So don't be confused as we read the English translation sometimes of these words, that these things must soon come to pass. Doesn't necessarily mean that everything that was talked about in the book of Revelation was going to happen in the next 2, 3, 5 years or something like that. So sometimes the confusion of Revelation comes about because of the translation into the English language. And we want to make some of that a little clearer as we go. Okay, now if you're following on your outline, if you'll look to page 6 of your outline, we'll start the last two sections of it today. And Lord willing, we might even be able to finish these two sections today and be ready to start chapter 1 next week. Sections 11 and 12 of my outline I've adapted from material for Alan Hires. From Alan Hires, okay? So a lot of the things that we talk about here, he has in some of his lectures and some of his written material. Section 11 here, we've built up to this point by laying a good groundwork, and now I think section 11 will bring some of this stuff together. And that is different approaches that are taken to studying the book of Revelation. There are different views that's taken toward a study of Revelation. I think we need to talk about these here briefly this morning, because the approach that one takes is going to affect our interpretation of the book. And I think you'll see that, especially as we look at the first couple of these. Opposite extremes, if you will, as we look at two of them. Matter of fact, how many of you have a study Bible? How many of you have a study Bible? I've got probably three or four different ones on my desk that I use all the time. And I hope that we can point out how careful we have to be in using study Bibles, especially in some of the material that we're going to talk about in Revelation here. Most of your study Bibles and books that you look at in Revelation will give you four different approaches to the study. And those are numbers 1 through 4 on your outline. Brother Alan Hires includes a number 5, and I think I can see the wisdom in doing that. We're going to talk about these 5 different viewpoints or vantage points from studying the book. 5 different approaches to studying the book. The first one here, and I'm going to just write the titles here on the board as we go. The first one here is called the preterist. I'll say the preterist view. The preterist view. The word preterist here comes from, or actually means, that which is past. That which is past. And the preterist here camp has, there are several different divisions in even within this group. But in general, we're talking about something that's already occurred. The preterist approach to Revelation says that everything in the book, maybe short of the second coming of the Lord and the view of heaven toward the end, but 99% of the book, this camp right here would say, it's already happened. It's already happened. Now the most common one, there are different ones, think that it might have happened in different times. For example, there's one that we might refer to called the late preterist that think that the book of Revelations had to do with the fall of Rome, which happened in A.D. what? 476. Rome fell in A.D. 476. There's some of the preterist view that says the book of Revelations had to do with the fall of Rome in A.D. 476. And everything that was prophesied happened by then. But the bulk of the preterist view here has to do with the fall of Jerusalem. The preterist, most of the time when you see this right here, you're talking about a group that thinks the book of Revelations had to do with the fall of Jerusalem and the fall of Judaism. Now tell me what that would mean as far as the date of the book goes. Remember we talked about 2 general dates that the book was written. If the book had to do with the fall of Jerusalem in A.D. 70, that would mean the book had to have been written prior to that, would it not?
Yes.
Remember I gave you one of the dates was A.D. 68. That's this group right here. If this approach right here, and I would say this to you, not many people hold this view anymore. You'll find it every now and then, but it is an approach that some people have. But at any rate, for this view to be true, it would necessitate the book having been written in A.D. 68, early on there, as opposed to A.D. 96. So this one is saying that the book is largely about the conflict. Remember now, we talked about conflict. The book is largely about the conflict between Christians and Judaism. Christians and Judaism. That's the conflict that's described according to the preterist here. So, and I will say this. One of the members of the church, older preachers, that has written several books, including a commentary on Revelation's name, is Foy E. Wallace. And Foy E. Wallace held the preterist view. He said that it had to do with the fall of Jerusalem in A.D. 70. Bill.
Well, when we read in the text here that those who read it and followed it would be blessed, but that view right there takes that away from them because it couldn't bless them now because it happened a long time ago. Everything happened.
That's very true. Very true. And so, right. I think that we can refute this as we go through and look at some of these others. And additionally, there's a lot of information here that points to a later time for the book to have been written. For example, when we get in chapters 2 and 3 and we talk about those seven churches over here and the conflict that they have, you get the feel that those churches are not young. They've been in existence long enough to spiritually decline. And so if you're looking at it, if you're looking at the book being written in AD 68, most of those churches over there would be 10 to 12 to 15 years old. It really hadn't been enough time elapsed for them to get in the condition that we'll find Laodicea and some of the others in when we get there. So I think all of the evidence that we've talked about really points to a later date. All right, let's talk about the second one here. The second one, I think, is what's going to gain a lot of your interest. Now, whereas the preterist here has to do with that which is past, the opposite end of that spectrum is the view we call the futurist view. The futurist view. Now, what do you think that has to do with?
That nothing has happened, that it's all going out.
The futurist has to do with the future. And this view right here says that once you get past chapter 3, the letters to the seven churches, then chapters 4 through 22 here has to do with something that's going to occur in the future.
The future to who? The ones who are living now?
Well, as a matter of fact, it is.
Okay.
Because a great deal of this view right here has to do with the 7 years at the end of time. Okay, now I want you to pay particular attention to this, because if you pick up a study Bible or if you go to the store and buy a book, I can almost guarantee you it's going to be from this view right here. This is very, very strong in the denominational world, and it's very strong in current literature, because this view right here is what we call premillennialism. Okay, we've talked about that before. Pre means what? Before. Millennium means what? 1,000. This view right here is talking about before the 1,000-year reign. This one has to do everything to do with things that we find in modern day literature, like the rapture and the Battle of Armageddon and the 7 years. And that's the futurist view, because this one says that most of the book of Revelations here has to do with the second coming of Christ. As a matter of fact, I've got it written here, chapters 4 through 19 would have to do with the second coming. Chapter 20 has to do with the 1,000 years, and chapter 21 and 22 is the eternal state of the church afterwards. So again, be very careful with picking up a study Bible or picking up a book and reading it, because chances are it's going to be written from someone who holds a view of premillennialism. And that would be the futurist view here.
The book, now, before this, the book, the great planet Earth.
Al Lindsey
started this, most of it at least, and 95% of it, of people that hold that view, were persuaded by him that he went through the like a brush fire.
Yeah.
And it just covered.
And as a matter of fact, Bill has made a really, really good point that if you trace the roots of where most of this came from, it's fairly recent. You know, within the last 100 years or so, most of everything. In fact, the book he's talking about, The Late Great Planet Earth, was written back, I believe, in the late 60s or early 70s or somewhere, give or take 10 years there. And the one that comes to my mind recently is the Left Behind series. You know, very popular with people reading these things, but it's from a view that prior to the second coming of Christ, there will be 7 years. He's coming. Well, actually, he's coming the second time, and he's going to take the faithful away from the earth. Don't you remember, you've seen probably stickers on cars that said, if this vehicle is unmanned, you know, after the rapture or something, that's part of this belief, that he will take the faithful away, and then there will be 7 years of tribulation for those that are left. At which time, then he comes back the third time, I might mention. You know, where do we find in Scripture about the third coming? But that'll be his third trip back, that he'll come back then, and the Battle of Armageddon will occur, and then you'll have he'll set up an earthly kingdom in the city of Jerusalem, and he'll reign on earth for 1,000 years. That's the futurist view. Now, I'll say this. One of the study Bibles I have at home, I really like. The guy is fairly conservative. His name is John MacArthur. John MacArthur has written some good materials. But here's what John MacArthur says in relation to premillennialism and the futurist view. And I quote, "Only this view does justice to Revelation's claim to be prophecy." So John MacArthur, even as conservative as he is, he holds a premillennialist view and the futurist view here. So just I can't emphasize enough for you to be careful about things that you pick up, because these writings oftentimes are very persuasive. And when you read some of these things, you get interested and you start to question some things, and you can be confused. There's a lot of confusion out there. I'd like to say this before we leave the futurist view and go on. What was the reason for writing the book of Revelation? Just in general, and I'm not looking for a specific answer, but what was the reason?
To give hope and comfort
to Christians because of what they were facing in the emperor worship and in the Roman Empire. Now, my question to you, if 95% of this book has to do with the last 7 years, of what hope and comfort was that to them?
It would really be none.
I mean, we're talking about something that's going to occur 2,000 or 3,000 years removed from those first century Christians. At least two, we know, right?
Yeah.
Justin?
Well, I would say that it would be of hope and comfort to them in the same sense that it's hope and comfort to us in the idea of heaven. I mean, I'm not a futurist view person, don't get me wrong, but even if it was a futurist view, direct, I think it would give them hope and comfort in the idea that, you know, heaven's waiting for them.
Okay.
And it might give them comfort that the church wouldn't fall until all that happened.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's go on here. Let's look at the third one. We have the preterist view. This view here saying that everything has already happened. The fall of Jerusalem occurred in A.D. 70. And the temple was destroyed in A.D. 70. And incidentally, that wasn't necessarily where did the end of Judaism really begin? The cross, wasn't it? At the cross, wasn't it? The cross, when Jesus died on the cross and nailed the old law to the cross here, then that really was the beginning. But the last nail, or the final nail, I guess, happened in A.D. 70. Because when the city of Jerusalem was destroyed and the temple was destroyed, then that destroyed all the Jewish records and all of the things that they held so dear. And so that was kind of the final nail, you know. And so preterist, that had to do with Christianity and Judaism. The futurist view, just remember premillennialism with this one. The third one that we need to talk about here is the historical view. Now, the historical view might be the one that many of you have held and still hold, and I'll say myself that there's a lot in this one here that probably is true. But the historical view has to do with what? What's the root word? History. That which is past, that which is future, the history. The historical view here says that the book of Revelations is a panoramic view of history. If you read the book of Revelation, you'll read about the fall of the Roman Empire. You'll read about the rise of the papacy, the Roman Catholic Church. You'll read about the French Revolution. You'll read about Islam and Muhammad. You'll read about the Dark Ages. You'll even read about the Protestant movement and the church today. You'll read about history from the days of the apostle until the second coming of the Lord. History, the historical approach here, lays out history here in symbolic form. Now, let me tell you this. This is very interesting because how many of y'all have the Gospel Advocate commentaries at home? Many of you, I'm sure, have the Gospel Advocate commentaries, and they're about as sound as you can get. Well, the book of the commentary of Revelation was written by a gentleman who served as the editor of the Gospel Advocate many years ago. His name was John T. Hines. And John T. Hines holds that approach right there, the historical view. And as I said, there's going to be a lot of this that we will that we'll be very interested in. There are others. How many of you have Barnes commentaries? I have Barnes commentaries at home. Barnes is not a Christian, but he's a very conservative scholar, and his commentaries are very good. He too holds a historical view here. So I found this interesting, and this was new. A lot of the stuff I've learned in this study has been new to me. But some people even contend that the seven churches of Asia, we're going to talk about what they represent when we get to chapter 2 and 3. But some people contend that the seven churches represent periods of history. That the church of Ephesus represented about 100 years there from the apostles to the next 100 or so years. And then the next church, and then the next church. And that we today, in the year 2012, are living in the period of the Laodicean church. That every one of those churches represent periods of history. I don't buy that. I think those churches were real physical churches. And I'll tell you what they did represent when we get over there into chapter 2 and 3. But it's interesting here about these historical views. And I'll say this was interesting. Very detailed and very technical as to what each sign and each symbol means. And I can't tell you exactly where this was, but there's somewhere in there that we're 30 minutes. This view right here says 30 minutes in heaven represented a 240-year period of history when there were no wars. From year such and such to 240 years later, there were no wars, a time of peace. And they say that 30 minutes is talked about in Revelation, that 30-minute period there represents that 240 years. So very technical, very detailed, if you will, but a blueprint of history. All right, then that brings us up to the fourth one here. And as I said, most of the book material you pick up and read would stop with this one, the idealism view or idealist view. And this one, as I put on your handout sheet here, says that the book contains really no historical information. It really contains no predictive information at all. It's just a collection of stories that teach spiritual truths. It's just it's idealists. It's presented in the ways of being an ideal situation, not a specific situation, but just an overall battle between good and evil. Not many would hold that view in this class. Not many would hold this view. I hope you don't hold this view right here. This is going to provide some things I think we'll be interested in, but I think that Brother Hires here, the fifth one that he adds will have the most interest for us, and that is the contextual view. And as I've written in your sheet here, contextual view grows out of the context for which it was written. Now, for example, if we were to go and study the book of Hebrews, the book of Hebrews here is written to Jewish Christians who were on the verge of renouncing their faith and turning back to Judaism. Apostatizing and going back to Judaism. We need to understand that context. That's to whom it was written, and that's where they were. And that makes the book of Hebrews really jump out and come alive to us. to understand the context that it was written in. Same thing about the book of 1 Corinthians. If we studied about the city of Corinth, we would say a very immoral city. A lot of sexual immorality going on and common in that city.
And then it leached out into the church.
And being in that city and knowing the church was in the midst of that, church just being people, that's the people that was in the midst of that. Then when we read about that in there, about the man who is going so far as to living with his father's wife, and the church allowing that without disciplining him, we understand that a little more because of the context that it's in. Now, the same thing is true, and probably even more so for Revelation. We need to understand the book of Revelations here from a view of what was the context. And that, to be honest with you, is why I've spent 6 weeks talking about the background information. When was it written? What was the present cultural and political environment that it was written in? See, that I think will help us a lot. So there'll be lessons that will apply to us today, because we might not be in exactly the same context, but are we subject to persecution? Do we have issues that we have to deal with? Yes, we do. And so we can identify with that by studying it from a contextual view here, and I think that's kind of the approach that we'll take. Yes, ma'am.
What time period was that view? Only because this study Bible, it's funny, it lists all four of them, but that one.
Well, that's what I said before. I don't know of a study Bible anywhere that's going to list this one. This one right here, this one is unique to Alan Heyer's, some of his material that he's put together. Now, I'm not saying he's the one that came up with it, nor am I saying he's the only one to hold it. But I'm just saying that all my study Bibles at home have these four right here. And most of the books you read will have these four right here. But he introduces a fifth view that says, let's look at it. Not necessarily, we're not going to do this. We've talked about the fallacy here. It was not written in AD 68. It was written in AD 69. Irenaeus. You remember all the other things that we talked about in AD 96? I'm sorry. Remember all the other things we talked about that validates an AD 96? If it's written in AD 96, that view won't work. That view won't work. That's 26 years after Jerusalem fell. Futurist view. Premillennialism. Strong in the denominational world, but error with a capital E. You can refute every bit of that. Christ is not coming back to the world the third time. You don't find that in Scripture. The historical view. Now we're going to talk about that indeed a lot of Revelation does have to do with the historical view. So I think that you can marry these two ideas right here, and that'll be kind of the approach that we take as we study. I certainly don't hold anything to this view. But Betty, this right here is just kind of, I guess, emphasizing that it's not only some of this right here, but that it's we need to talk about the context. We need to talk about emperor worship. We need to talk about what was going on in Asia Minor when these seven letters were written here, and the persecution from the Roman Empire. And what does it mean when we get over here and John saw he looked under the altar and saw the souls of those who had been killed? You know, those are loved ones here. That John is writing to some of these family members whose loved ones have died for the cause of Christ. And they where are they? And John is writing. That's context, see? That's the context that we're talking about. Carrie, you have...
What is unique to Brother Hires, or whether he got that from someone else, I imagine that it came, that particular view, from an overall understanding of trying to harmonize prophecy throughout the Bible. Because if you want to go back and understand the prophecy of the Old Testament, you can't adequately do that without understanding the conditions in which the prophet wrote. What was happening in Israel or Judah or in the captivity years? What was going on? And any of the signs or any of the symbols that might be used in there, you would never be able to put pieces together unless you understood that book in light of what was happening at the time of the writing.
Exactly. Excellent comment. The context. Any others?
You know, Glenn, today, if we were sort of looking at an overview of America, we would look at something like New Orleans, Las Vegas, San Francisco, those places that harmonize with something in our mind, say, this is that moral part.
Mm-hmm.
But we just mentioned that and say, well, this is just another little Las Vegas.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, all of them. Atlantic City. We understand that kind of thing.
And as a matter of fact, we even do that by referring to Sodom, don't we? I mean, we even have sodomizing, you know, and things that we know exactly what it means, but that it actually takes its meaning from the scripture there. Yeah. Sadly to say, it's true. True. Any other comments? Let's look real quickly at page 7 here. I may come back and visit this a little more, but the last section I have in your study guide, and again coming from Brother Heyer's material, is just a summary of the book. And this is just to give you an idea of what is in each one of the chapters here. And then we'll go into a little closer examination of this material. We're just looking at what's there and not necessarily any explanation of the contents now, but as we go through, we will. Although, remember, we're not going to try to get bogged down on specific details and what does this mean and what does that mean and every little thing, which I think probably the historical view does. And again, very technical and very detailed is what they mean. We're not going to do that. But just looking at this overall summary here in chapter 1, we're going to talk about an introduction. You think, well, Glenn, we've been talking about that for six weeks. But we're going to talk about what is in chapter 1 here in the way of introduction. And incidentally, and y'all don't laugh at me when I say this, we're going to try to stick to one chapter a week when we get started. We're just going to present some highlights here and move on and try to look at the big picture. Yeah, folks, if we do that, there's 22 chapters, so we're looking at 22 weeks worth of study. So y'all don't hold me to that, but that's kind of what we're going to attempt to do. So the introduction. Now, chapters 2 and 3 are the practical parts, very practical parts. And I was talking with someone before class today. It is going to be difficult not to really get bogged down there, because you could take these 7 letters to the 7 churches there. You could take those letters and study them a long time and get a lot of information out about that. But what I want us to do, we're going to look at each one of these 7 churches. I'm going to give you some charts, and you'll see some of the commendations and some of the recommendations and things that are given to each one of them. And at the end of chapter 3, I'm going to ask you a very, very pointed question. And it's simply going to be this. Which one of these 7 does Northport identify with? We'll find ourselves in one of those 7 pictures. We'll find ourselves in one of those 7 pictures. And there are some of them that God has nothing bad to say about. And there's one that God has nothing good to say about. And then there's all in between here. And if we're honest with ourselves, we'll find Northport somewhere in there. We'll find where we aspire to be, but if we're honest with ourselves, we'll find where we are. That's chapter 2 and 3. Now, chapter 4 is really when it gets the visions began, and that's when the apocalyptic language really becomes real important. Chapter 4 is God on the throne. We talk about 24 elders and 4 living creatures. Chapter 5, we encounter the book with 7 seals, sealed 7 times. And chapter 5 says, who's worthy to open the book? And we find one person that's worthy to open the book. And who is that?
Jesus Christ.
That's the Lord. He's the worthy one. Worthy is the Lamb. Then chapter 6, we begin opening those seven seals that are found within there. And we talk about the first through the sixth there in chapter 6. Now chapter 7, we've got a little thing here that's an interlude. Chapter 7 is kind of a parenthetical explanation, if you will. Time out. Chapter 6, you talk about the sixth seal, and then it's almost like you say, time out. Let's talk about this. And we give some encouragement here in this chapter. And then chapter 8, you go back and pick up that seventh seal. And then the sounding of the seven trumpets. What number are we talking about all the time here? Seven. Seven, that perfection or that complete number. Seven trumpets. And then down in number 10, we get chapter 10, we'll find the little book. We'll measure the temple in the chapter 11 with the two witnesses. That'll be an interesting discussion. And in chapter 12, we really turn a lot deeper in the symbolism here in chapter 12 and 13. That's the woman and the child. We'll encounter that beast with what number? 666. On his forehead. 666, that's right. And the Lamb and the redeemed and so forth. So incidentally, chapter 17 is my mistake. Fall of Babylon. You probably picked up my misspelled word there on Babylon. That won't be the only mistake I've ever made. Very good. Thank you for your presence, and we'll continue next Sunday.
Enjoyed it.
I won't be here next Sunday.
Okay. That's when we're going to really start.